Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. This past March, we took the show on the road to Penn State's Hub Robeson Center's Freeman Auditorium to talk with New York Times bestselling author Jess Walter. His 2012 masterpiece, Beautiful Ruins, was this year's Center County Reed selection. NPR's Fresh Air called the book a literary miracle. Salon called it damn near perfect. The book enjoyed 69 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, 5 at number one. Anyone who read about the author at the end of the book, they know that it took you 15 years to write and then rewrite Beautiful Ruins. And in fact, in 2008, you thought you were finished. 48 hours later, you realized it wasn't quite right. And so given what went into bringing it to life, I'm wondering just what it was like to finally release this work to the world.
Wow. It's hard when you say you worked on a book for 15 years. As I say in the afterword, it's one of those things I hate when writers say that, because it makes it sound like the job is much more difficult. And it also, there's a sense of inevitability, like, well, I knew this was going to be a masterpiece, so I decided to spend 15 years on it. And the truth is that I failed at it for 14 and a half years. And so during that long process, I never once thought I had a sense of the story. So to finally finish it, I was still filled with all those misgivings. I remember describing it at one point during an event. I was doing an event with Timothy Egan, who's another writer friend of mine from Spokane, and other books of ours had come out, and someone said, what are you working on now? And I said, well, I have two novels. I'm working on a novel about a suburban cattle ranch that I haven't quite finished, and I have this other novel that's about Hollywood, Italy, fame, and the Donner Party.
And, just too much.
And there was a pause, and Tim said, I think you should work on the cattle ranching novel. So my first sense when I finished it was, will anyone see how these disparate worlds come together, the sort of thematic connection? And so it was really my agent who loved the book, and it was great to hear back from him that he thought it had succeeded.
Well, it's interesting because there is so much in this book, and that's part of the beauty of it. You've got one chapter from Alvis Bender's never-written novel.
Right.
You've got a Hollywood movie pitch, a chapter of Michael Dean's memoir. All of that in there, in this wonderful journey that crosses two continents, has two main characters, but lots of other players. Was there one person for whom you started the whole story around?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, my first image of the story was Dee arriving in this small village. I went to the Cinque Terre in 1997. My wife's Italian, and we were visiting relatives up and down the boot, and because she has so many relatives, they were torturing us with food. I think of it as pasta boarding. They would constantly just shove different forms of pasta down our throats, and almost to get away from relatives, we looked for some remote place we could go, and it was February. It was the middle of the rainy season. We were the only tourists who got off the train at Monte Rosso al Mare, and we went to sleep that night, you know, with this driving rain, and I woke up the next morning and threw open the shutters on, you know, the beautiful sea in front of our window. In that moment, I kind of fell in love with the place. And the idea, the romance that these were villages that you could only arrive at by boat at one time, made me want to write about the place. Eventually, because I couldn't fit my fictional world around one of these real villages, I chose both the 1960s and to make up my own village, Port of Vergogna, Port of Shame, as the setting for the novel. And so initially it was really Dee and Pasquale, it was their novel.
Dee and Pasquale, and it wasn't until 2006, I believe, that you decided to inject Cleopatra and Richard Burton.
Well,
into the story.
They had come along earlier. The first character to sort of work his way into the story, I was stuck with this one chapter forever. And the way I tend to write, I start at the beginning, and I can't really move forward until the beginning feels just right. So often I will stick on the very beginning of a novel. And with this one, it was she arrived in his village the only way one could come directly in a boat that motored around the cove. And I'd think, who is she? Who is he? I have all these pronouns with no reference. Where are they going? going. And so I was constantly reworking the beginning of the novel, and it really felt like for 7 years Pasquale was standing in the ocean.
You know,
I was so afraid that he would get hypothermia, you know, and that Dee would never get off the boat. And when I first got back from Italy, my mother was diagnosed with stomach cancer. So the original vision of this woman arriving in this village, my mom had been a housewife and had never gotten to travel. And I originally just wanted to take my mom someplace she'd never been, some fictional version of my mom. That vision of the story quickly died away, and I thought, who is this woman, Dee? And while I was imagining that, I thought, maybe I need someone else to come to the village to sort of open it up. And I created another problem. I'd named the Hotel Adequate View, which is not a typically Italian male thing to do, Italian men not being big on understatement, right? So I decided I would have an American writer come, and with his acerbic sense of humor, name it the Hotel Adequate View. And I decided he was a writer. First, I thought he was a travel writer, and then I decided he would be driven by some Hemingway-esque desire to write his war story. And then I just really wanted to see his war story. And that's when the story began sort of, rather than venturing the way a story normally does, I wanted this sort of breadth and back and forth of this storytelling, almost like waves. And then it was probably 5, 6, 7 years down the road that I realized she was an actress, and that I stumbled on on Cleopatra, the other disaster. Yeah.
The great thing about stumbling on Cleopatra is, I understand you read Richard Burton's diaries, and there is this period, the same period in which your book starts, yeah, where he wasn't writing in his diaries, so, you know, who could dispute that this happened?
Yeah, the diaries themselves were actually published after Beautiful Ruins came out. They recently came out, and they are incredible. I mean, he's a terrific writer, an amazing drinker and womanizer, you know, every bit the character. I may have made him a little too shy, actually. But I had seen references to him. I had read about the diaries and read excerpts. Melvin Bragg in his book about Burton quotes from them extensively. And there was a gap between 1960 and 1964 when he didn't keep a diary, this lifelong diarist. And so it was really interesting for me to imagine sliding this incident into a historical figure that really lived.
Now, you don't keep a diary, but you do keep a writing journal. Tell us a little bit about, there it is, you never go anywhere without it. So are there notes in there about State College?
I can't really say. It's, you know, if anyone else ever picked up my diary, they would be so bored, because it says things like, end second chapter with a coda, bring back Steve from chapter one and have him do this, you know. It's really just notes to myself. There are some exhortations, stop being so lazy, you know, there are some notes to myself, but it's really a working journal. And I do carry it with me everywhere, because there have been times when I haven't had it with me, and so I have to jot notes on cocktail napkins, and I have a whole lot.
And you could lose those.
I have a whole lot of cocktail napkins. I start to worry I have a problem if I have too many notes on cocktail napkins.
You know, while we say that it took 15 years to bring Beautiful Ruins to life, in that time you also published 5 other novels, 20 or so short stories, right, and thousands of other shorter pieces, essays, right, and reviews, poems, even screenplays, and you seem to have no tolerance, in a way, for writer's block. Just switch gears.
You know, I come from a really blue-collar family, and I've made this joke before, but my dad worked in an aluminum plant, and he never woke up in the morning and said, I have aluminum block today. You know, I'd love to go pour molten metal, but it's just not happening for me. You know, you weren't allowed to do that. And I went into journalism as my training, and I am a writer, so I know how easy it is to whine about the writing process. But anyone who's done real work knows that you can always find something to say. You know, one of the reasons Beautiful Ruins took 15 years is to avoid writer's block, I switch. If I get stuck on something, then I'll work on something else. I don't want to leave the desk. I want to make sure I put my work in before I leave the desk. And in that way, I might switch from a novel to a short story. I might even switch novels. You know, and sometimes you just hit a wall on a novel. And I used to be so afraid of time. I used to be afraid of the way time moved, and my own sense of mortality made me think I wasn't going to get a book done. And if Beautiful Ruins taught me anything, it's patience. I could not have finished the book when I started. I hadn't lived enough.
You weren't mature enough in a way. You hadn't lived enough.
Yeah. I mean, in the course of writing that book, I lost a parent, had another parent diagnosed with Alzheimer's, had two more children born, had one leave the house. You know, in the process of writing that book, so much life occurs to you, and you're trying to capture some authentic sense of life on the page. You know, and the scope of the book too, you know, to have that many years pass from beginning to end, I think the scope sometimes, hopefully, is reflected in the book itself.
You started off as a journalist. You always, from the time you were a kid, you wanted to be a literary novelist. So you start off as a journalist, you become a nonfiction author, then a ghostwriter, then a mystery novelist, and then a literary novelist. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how your beginning as a journalist benefited everything that's come since.
Yeah, I always say that I took the service entrance into literature. I was a dad at 19, and you can't just go to work in the novel factory to support a kid, so as much as I would love to have. So for me, the way to support my daughter and to support a family was to take a job at a newspaper, and it turned out to be the best training for me. I miss my old newspaper colleagues. I think of them as my tribe. I used to call newspaper reporters the most brilliant C students you've ever met, like the greatest underachievers in the world, really bright people who do something different every day. And that sense of writing every day, of getting my chops, working in a newspaper, I didn't always get to write what I wanted. It was like being a piano player in a dive bar. People would put a little song in the glass and you'd play that song, but boy, can I play a bad piano fast. And I think that helped the sense of writing. I'm not afraid of publishing. I'm not even afraid of publishing work that might not be my very best, you know. So the ability to research, to look outward in the world. One of my pet peeves with literary fiction right now is the Karl Ove Knausgård movement toward writing this deep interior stuff, and the last thing I feel like the culture needs is another selfie. And so one thing I love about journalism is it teaches you to look outward into the world, and I still have a belief that among the other things it can do, because it can be a great way to show identity and self, one of the things that literature can do is address social issues and teach us about the world out there, not just inside.
One of your literary heroes is Don DeLillo, mm-hmm. who says that writers have a responsibility to write against power, against a mindless consumption, against meaningless entertainment. And it seems in a way that you've taken some of that to heart as sort of an underlying theme here in Beautiful Ruins.
Yeah, you know, the journalist creed is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I think that it's similarly, I would agree completely, you know, that writing a novel is a bit of a subversive thing, especially in this culture. We live in a culture in which we want information instantly. If I were to sit down and tell a young person you're going to work on something, it's going to take you 15 years. That's not the way the culture works. If I can't fit it in 140 characters, then maybe I don't want to. So the very act of writing something contemplative and slower moving and immersive in that way is a bit subversive, and I think you have to write against the grain of the culture. Novelists have been doing that for as long as the novel's been around.
If you're just joining us, I'm Patty Satalia, and this is a special edition of Take Note on WPSU. Back in March, we talked with New York Times bestselling author Jess Walter, whom the Philadelphia Inquirer has called a genius of the modern American moment. Walter joined us at Penn State's Hub Robeson Center for a beautiful night of literary conversation about his novel Beautiful Ruins. It was this year's Center County Reads selection. Another one of your literary heroes is Kurt Vonnegut. He's always asked, to what extent are his works autobiographical? Right. And he says, this is not my life, it's how life feels to me.
Right.
And I found that interesting because as I read Beautiful Ruins, and I knew that you were a father at 19, the theme of fatherhood just jumped off the page for me with Pasquale and leaving his girlfriend in Florence and Richard Burton thinking he's having a baby. And so to what extent is Pasquale or any of the other characters a sliver of you?
Yeah, very much, I think. I was talking to some of the writing students here and I said, what I look for is a sort of emotional purchase in the characters I'm writing. Some place of connection where I feel like I can imagine what they're thinking. And the other writer who I love quoting is Marilynne Robinson. When someone asked her, are any of these characters you? And she said, oh my goodness, yes, all of them. And I think there's a place where you do sort of intersect with those characters. And I write about fatherhood a lot. It's, in some ways, I think it was the most profound thing that's ever happened. In every way, it's been the most profound thing. You know, at the time, becoming a father so young, I thought it had limited so many choices and opportunities. But what it really does is it shows you what it means to care for someone more than yourself. But that's kind of a gift to get at 19.
The truth is, though, you are the exception, because if you look at teen parents, only 2% ever finish college. You got a master's degree. You have a degree in journalism and creative writing. How do you think, and especially because you didn't come from a literary family, right. How do you think you were able to achieve
that?
Well,
I don't actually have a master's degree. And I think
my
bachelor's.
Somewhere I would
do an MFA. Yes. No. I've taught an MFA program, which is great. The first thing I tell the students is, by the way, I don't have the degree that I'm teaching you right now. So I'll turn around, and any that want to leave, I will totally understand. No, I very much am the exception, and my work now, a lot of the things I write about, I'm really driven by the idea of class, because class is really about opportunity. And the fable we're told about America is that we have equal opportunity. We all have the same chance to succeed, and we know that's not the case. We know that some people, the deck is stacked against them. I was very fortunate. I was lucky. I had, supportive parents. I worked hard. I have been fortunate. And I also, I don't know that I was a typical teenage pregnancy. I was in college. But at the same time, I'm the first in my generation, the first male to graduate from high school, let alone college. And so the economic place that I come from, it is a little bit uphill, and you take pride in what you've done, but you also want to make it easier for people coming behind you. That idea of equity of opportunity, I feel like, is something we need to really strive for. I went to college for $700 a year, and otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here. I would be working at Gino's Italian Food still, bussing tables, because I would not have been able to go to afford college except for that low, low tuition. Mm-hmm. And to watch tuition rise, to watch exclusive colleges get more and more exclusive, to see poorer kids cut off from the opportunity to succeed, not the guarantee, of course not, but at least the opportunity, sort of breaks my heart.
You said your father read your books and often said, I'm not sure what you're writing about.
Yeah.
But did he support, did your parents support what you were doing?
My parents were incredibly supportive. My mom died young. My dad, and I think this is true of a lot of men, my dad just does not like novels. He said, I don't know who's talking to me. with a nonfiction book, he loves my nonfiction, But, and when I first started working as a novelist, it baffled my dad a little bit, because up until about a year ago, he was still showing me jobs in the want ads, just because he was so afraid. And I finally did an event that I brought him to. I remember when I first started going out on book tour, I would say, yeah, I'm going out on book tour. And he said, well, what do you do on book tour? And I said, well, I sometimes speak to colleges, sometimes to different groups. I give readings. And he got this funny look. He said, you wrote the damn thing? You have to read it to them too? And I said, no, I don't read them the whole book, just part of it. So it was great to bring him to a reading a few years ago, and there were 400 people there, and he just kept looking around. And since then, he's let me buy every meal. So he's no longer pointing out jobs in the want ads. So I know he's crazy proud of me. And yet it was terrifying for him, because the aluminum plant where he worked shut down, and he lost his pension, and the jobs that he thought of as the place that a man went to support his family didn't exist anymore. And here I was sitting in a room trying to make up stories. It was a world beyond him.
You grew up in Spokane, Washington, mm-hmm. and it's interesting because that also features in some of your stories. Mm-hmm. And you talk about it often as this place you're so grateful to have had as a place to grow up. On the other hand, almost a little embarrassed that you're still there. So I'd like you to kind of describe or explain this love-hate relationship for this hometown that actually sounds like a good place for a writer to be
from. Oh, it's a great place. I think one of my connections with Pasquale is, here's a guy tied to his hometown, and I very much you know, becoming a dad at a certain age and then having more kids and, you know, being sort of tied to a place. I did feel tied to it for the longest time. Spokane has will always have an inferiority complex towards Seattle and Portland. Seattle and Portland are so hip. And now Spokane has come along. I mean, it is bike trails and locavore restaurants. It's like a mini Portland, so much that it's kind of irritating me. Like, I want to find a diner that is still a real diner, not a mock diner pretending to be a diner. I don't want an ironic diner. I just want... And every restaurant in Spokane now, the chef wants to put a drizzle on it. And in Spokane, if the chef put a drizzle on something before, you left the restaurant because it meant he had an infection of some kind. So now we have all these James Beard-trained chefs that want to drizzle on everything. And I just want some eggs sometimes, you know. So my old blue-collar home is becoming very much like a spin-off of Portlandia, but it's actually great. I mean, it's a great place for writers, it's a great place for the culture, but it has sort of grown up around me, a lot of the things that I thought I wanted, and I've managed to see the world with that as my home base, but I feel very much like a throwback. There aren't very many writers who've stayed in their hometown. There are very few writers who, you know, were fathers at 19. You know, most of my writer friends are much older and just now starting to have kids, and they all live in a 4-block radius of Brooklyn, New York, you know, so they're all packed in these big writer high rises. So I think, again, to live against the grain without knowing you are, but it's a great city. It was poor and blue collar growing up, and I think some of those things I longed to escape, and now I long to be surrounded by them.
So many of the places that you've been become part of your stories.
Yeah.
They figure into your play. So I'm wondering to what extent in those 15 years you carried your characters around with you.
That's a great phrase, Patty. I did carry them around with me. And, you know, I didn't go on an airplane until I was 20. My first trip east of Wyoming was book tour. My very first book was coming out, and they said, "We're flying you to New York." And I said, "Of course you are." And they said, "Your first thing will be Nightline." Right, I'll do Nightline. And then the next morning you're going to do Good Morning America. Of course I am. Yes, that makes perfect sense. And the whole thing felt so out of body.
I think we should tell people what your first book was.
My first book was a nonfiction book about Ruby Ridge. And while I was working on it, Congress announced they were going to conduct hearings into Ruby Ridge. So suddenly it was a great big news story. And my brother still tells the story of me sitting across from Sam Donaldson being interviewed and him saying, "I never realized how tiny your head was until they would go to Sam Donaldson, then they'd go to you. Sam Donaldson, you. And you had this tiny pinhead, and I just kept squeezing your little pinhead and thinking, don't show his head anymore. It's so freakishly tiny." I was 29 years old and a little overwhelmed. And so I still sort of travel like a kid. Every place I go, I think, can't believe I'm here, and I fill my notebook and I look for excuses and reasons to write. I was in Amsterdam last year, and I immediately, you know, couldn't believe how beautiful and wonderful it was. So I'm going back this year to finish the story that I started, the Amsterdam story I started there. So I think it's kind of a great way to see the world, and it's a really natural, I think, extension for a writer. To be a writer is to be a tourist in your own country, to carry a notebook around and notice things and see the world in that way.
Well, has your life as a writer turned out to be the life you imagined it would be when you were just fantasizing about being a writer?
I'm so far beyond the fantasies I had of being a writer. I dreamed one day that I would have a book, that I would have a book with my name on it, and I would walk around the shelves and I would file it next to Steinbeck for a while, and then I would take it out and I'd file it next to Joan Didion, and that was really as far as I never thought I could make a living as a writer. I didn't know any novelists who did. The writers that I idealized their lives when I was younger, Kurt Vonnegut, some writers like that, I don't think I ever really thought that would happen. And I was telling the students today, I never saw writing as a profession. I was a journalist. That's what I was going to do. I saw writing as a religion, as I believed in it, you know, with all of my being, I guess. And it was the way I saw the world, the way I tried to explain the world. The way the world made sense to me was reading and writing.
So one day, Kurt Vonnegut writes a book, and he sends you a copy. That must have been a real trip.
To my shame, I stalked Kurt Vonnegut when I was young. There was a brief moment when he was, when I was a kid, I used to go to my school library and I would crouch in the stacks and imagine where my book would be filed when I was older. And when I was 13 or 14, I was at my school library and I crouched down and to see where the W's were, and right before that was Vonnegut. So I grabbed a copy of his book, Breakfast of Champions. And I took it home, and I got to page 8, I believe. And on page 8, Vonnegut writes, "This is my drawing of an asshole." And he has an asterisk. And as a 13-year-old, I thought, that's the most brilliant thing I've ever seen in my life. And then later, he talks about going in his own book and setting free his characters. And that seemed to me the most subversive thing. You could go in your own book and set your characters free. Sure enough, at the end of Breakfast of Champions, he does just that. And from that moment on, Vonnegut became a hero. And as much for the way he talked about writing, the way he talked about life, the way he wrote books that invited people in with humor, his humanism, his sense that we needed to do better by one another. So when I was 19 or 20, I had this brilliant idea as a journalist that if I got press credentials, I could go to hear various authors. And so the first author I went to hear getting my phony press credentials was Ken Kesey. Mm-hmm. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Sometimes a Great Notion, one of my favorite writers. And I sat in the front row and I asked my one question, what advice would you give to a young writer? Second writer to come to my hotel was Tom Wolfe, another favorite writer of mine. He spoke at Eastern Washington University, high collars and imperious way, and I loved the right stuff and electric Kool-Aid acid test. And then the third writer to come to my hometown was Kurt Vonnegut. So I did the same thing. I got phony press credentials and I showed up, but there were no other reporters to ask questions. There was just me and Kurt Vonnegut. So we're sitting across from each other. Our knees are almost touching and I'm sitting across from the reason I want to be a writer. And I said, if you had to give advice to a young writer, maybe someone who hasn't had all the advantages, and my voice is cracking out. He said, can I ask you a question? How old are you? And I said, well, I'm 19. And he said, and you're working for Esquire? And I said, well, they haven't exactly accepted the piece. And and in that moment, he was so generous. He spent the next few minutes talking about writing. And when he was done, he said, do you need anything else? I said, no, thank you. It was great. And that night after his speech, he saw me in the front row and he pointed to me and he said, did you get everything you needed today? And I said, I did, thank you. And he said, well, I look forward to reading it. So I wrote a piece later when he came back to Spokane, and I ended the piece with that line, I look forward to reading it. And then I said, well, here it is, Mr. Vonnegut. And then not long after that, he sent a book, showed up in the mail. And when I opened it, it said, to my fellow novelist, Jess Walter, this is the one book of mine that wrote itself. All the others refused. Your friend, Kurt Vonnegut.
What's really terrific about that story is he sends you a book about a book that wrote itself, and after you wrote your book, Beautiful Ruins, The Financial Lives of the Poets is a book that you said almost wrote itself. By comparison, you did this one in 8 or 9 months.
Yeah, it was actually when I was stuck on Beautiful Ruins. Okay. So after I finished that draft in 2008, I showed my best friend, a great reader, a professor at Gonzaga University, a wonderful poet named Dan Butterworth, and he is always my first reader. And I gave it to him. I said, I finally did it. 11 years in the making. And he read it. He said, I don't think you have it. So we're not friends anymore, of course. But and I was so devastated. And The Zero was a really difficult novel, the novel before that. And then Beautiful Ruins. Right. And then Beautiful Ruins was such a difficult novel to put together because of these many pieces and all these different things. So I just wanted to get out of my way. I just wanted writing to be fun and easy again. So I told myself, I'm going to write a story in real time based on what's going on around me. And right then, the economy was collapsing. So I wrote The Financial Lives of the Poets in about 10 months. So when people ask me how long does a novel take to write, I say anywhere between 10 months and 15 years. So, and I'm telling the truth.
Jess Walter visited Penn State in March. His very funny novel, Beautiful Ruins, was this year's Center County Read Selection. To hear more of this interview, check the link on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.